Hello there. I'm Alice Roberts. I'm Vice President of Humanists UK, and you've found your way to this fantastic Humanist podcast. So I'm thinking you might be interested in finding out a little bit more about Humanists UK, which is the national charity working on behalf of non-religious people to advance free thinking, to combat discrimination against non-religious people, and also promote generally a fairer, more tolerant society. If you'd like to support the podcast or find out more about the humanist approach to life and all the work of Humanists UK, please visit the website. It's easy to find if you just search for humanists.uk. If you like what you see there, please consider joining us as a member. I'll let you get back to the podcast.
Today I'm chatting to Sandy Toksvig, writer, comedian, broadcaster and all-round superstar. You may know Sandy as the host of BBC's QI or the former co-presenter of The Great British Bake Off, but she's been a regular on our screens and in our radios for many decades now. At Humanists UK, we know Sandy as our patron and a great champion for human rights and equality. This year she called for the removal of the 26 unelected bishops from the House of Lords over their opposition to conducting same-sex marriages, and she also led calls alongside Stephen Fry for the UK government to give legal recognition to humanist marriages in England and Wales, focusing on the impact a change in the law would have had, especially for same-sex couples. Sandy, thank you for joining us on What I Believe.
It's a complete pleasure.
When we both attended the World Humanist Congress recently at Copenhagen, you said that you had quite a few important values from your father, who was Denmark's foreign correspondent. So I thought we might start there. Tell us a little about him and about what he taught you.
Well, I like that you say he was Denmark's foreign correspondent, because it means that you understand he was the foreign correspondent. We only had the one.
It's actually true,
yeah. It's the 1960s. And I'll give you an idea that my father worked for Danish television, but it was still known as Danish radio, because they weren't entirely sure that the whole thing with pictures was going to work out. So he became a television correspondent for the radio, which is quietly pleasing, I think. My dad was incredibly well-read. He didn't go to university because it just was not an option. But he was, despite his lack of formal education, the cleverest person I think I've ever met, very thoughtful, incredibly well read. He taught me lots of silly things, amongst which I have always agreed, never trust a man in a ready-made bow tie. I think if you can't tie a bow tie, then don't bother with the whole thing. I think that's just ridiculous. He taught me that one martini is not enough and three is too many. I think
that's important value.
I think that's a very important value. He taught me, as far as facts are concerned, to make sure that you had three sources for every single thing that you wanted to thoroughly believe in. So he was a brilliant foreign correspondent, but he was absolutely painstaking in his research. Now, sometimes it was sort of remarkable. I remember when he was doing the live commentary for Denmark for Prince Charles and Princess Diana's wedding, he was very determined to find any Danish connection whatsoever that he could, and he managed to discover, and I remember the glee with which he told us that Kiri Tikanawa, the opera singer who sang at the wedding, was wearing earrings made by a Danish jeweller.
Wow.
he'd really narrowed it down to the lobes of an Australian or New Zealander, isn't he? A New Zealander. And I love that he bothered. But he's trying to make a connection with the audience. He's trying to make them feel somehow involved at this great big international occasion. And he was determined that I understood that lots of people said things because it benefited them and it wasn't necessarily the truth. Mm. And that was particularly true of politics, if you imagine that I was in the United States with my dad covering the news during the Watergate era and so on.
Right.
You can imagine that truth was a slippery beast even then, and very sadly he would be horrified. It has become even more slippery.
And do you have that now then, a love of truth?
Is
that one of your things?
I do, although I increasingly find it incredibly difficult to narrow down. What is your truth and my truth are incredibly different. what would be nice, even if you and I had exactly the same experience. We did. We both went to the Humanist Congress in Copenhagen. I imagine we have a very different view of even the same moment.
Yes, of course.
Of what happened. In an ideal world, what would happen is that we would appreciate that those views are different. We would sit down and we would try and find a common ground in them. What's happening more and more, particularly if you look at, for example, politics in the United States, is that people are becoming increasingly polarized. And if you don't agree 100% with what I say is the truth, then you are my enemy. And that is not a way forward for anybody.
So what's the opposite of that? If that's what you don't want, that clash or that polarization, what's the opposite? Is it acceptance of diversity? Is it tolerance? Is it more active than that?
No, I think it's more active than that. I think it's a thoughtfulness. I think it's an active pursuit of trying to understand what it's like to walk in another person's shoes. It's trying to understand why their mindset might be like that. What I find intolerable, and I am an impatient person, is when somebody says something that they blatantly know to not be the truth. Again, sticking with the United States, Donald Trump saying that he won the election is insane. It's just mad. There's just madness there. But, you know, my beautiful wife, who you know, Demi, is a therapist. And she says, other people's madness drives you mad yourself. It brings something up in you, makes you feel crazy. And lately, more and more when people make statements, I just think, seriously, do you properly believe that? The trouble is, I don't even think you actually believe that. And yet you're putting it out as a truth.
And you said a moment ago that you're impatient. Is that a good thing as well as a bad thing? Do you think that that has virtues in it?
I get a lot done. I don't sit about, as you know, I think, Andrew.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a sort of dynamism, isn't it? You're intolerant of sitting about.
Yeah, I'm always doing something. I can't watch television without making something. I'm always multitasking. So my favorite thing would be, for example, to have lots of friends around for a chat, but I'm cooking at the same time. Something's happening. The person who just lags about it, that doesn't work for me.
Do you know where that comes from? Is it something you've always...
No, I don't know. I don't know where it comes from. I think early on, I mean, maybe I do. When I was in my early 20s, between my second and my third year of university, I was extremely unwell and very nearly died. And I think it left me with a desire to make the most of every single day that I have. Mm. It's a very sobering thing to have happened to you. I think it's probably left me with a enormous dynamic to grab life by the throat.
When you were talking about what your father was like a moment ago, you talked about his love of truth, but you also talked about his desire to connect, to engage, you know, by finding that one thing that would bring it alive for its Danish audience. I get the sense that that's something that you believe in too, engaging, connecting.
Absolutely. I trained initially as a human rights lawyer. And I have a great friend of mine, the brilliant Helena Kennedy, and she is a wonderful human rights lawyer. And I sometimes say to her, well, I think I made a mistake, Helena, and I should have pursued that path. And she said, Sandy, you can do more for human rights with a well-placed joke, probably, than a well-placed case. she's kidding, but
sometimes... That's true, culture matters.
Yeah, I do think culture matters, and I do... one woman shows, or I have done in the past, where I'm not just trying to make people laugh, I'm trying to make them think. I'm trying to get them to say, oh, well, maybe that is an amusing thought that people have not always been entirely sensible.
And connection is as important as engagement, really.
Yeah, I think so. I think you try and find the thing in the audience that you think, well, maybe this is the way in to say the thing that I want to say. So I do make very strong feminist points when I'm speaking, but I try and do it in a gentle way, and I try and do it in a way that makes everybody laugh. There's no point in just appealing to the feminists in the audience. What you want is maybe the guy in the audience whose partner made him come and who doesn't want to be there. You want to get him on side.
Let's come on to feminism, shall we? Or at least the values of women's equality and related values, because of course you began the Women's Equality Party, and it's had mixed fortunes, but it's had an impact for sure. Being out there with that, you know, with that single banner raising the importance of that issue. Obviously, it's important to you. It's important to you as a woman, I imagine. But it must have come from somewhere else as well in your experience and life.
Well, I noticed more and more that none of the political parties, and I mean not one of them, were focusing on women's issues when they were campaigning. I remember an extraordinary moment when the London mayoral election was happening, and none of the candidates knew that the Women's Equality Party had been allowed to submit a candidate. So there were seven candidates sitting on stage discussing things, and we got through all seven, and not one had mentioned the Women of London, not a single one. So, you know, 51% of London, and there was not a mention. And when we were revealed as a candidate, they were all furious. They were all furious. I remember Sadiq Khan came up to me and he said, that was very unfair. And I just thought, well, do you know, Sadiq, it was open to you to talk about women. Like, we were, you know, in the audience as a general thing. So it was as if we'd played some horrible Trump card that nobody else had ever thought of. There was never an intention, I don't think, or, you know, I'm not an idiot. We never thought that the Women's Equality Party was one day going to lead the country. But what it does is it makes people think about it. It makes them have to answer the questions. It makes them have to have a view, have to have some kind of policy. We've managed to get two elected councillors. But the main thing that we've managed to do, the greatest triumph of which I'm enormously proud in the past general election, it's very expensive to stand candidates. We only had the money to stand five candidates. So we stood five survivors of domestic abuse against five existing members of parliament, each of whom had an outstanding allegation of sexual abuse or harassment. And I can tell you, we didn't win, except we did, because none of those five are currently in parliament.
That's
all
very powerful.
Lost their seats, and indeed one is in prison. To me, that's a winner. Mm. That's how you win. That is a success. Mm. Those five men no longer represent anybody in the UK. So is that, you know, that's not how you normally decide that a party has been successful? To me, yeah, it's a fantastic matrix.
It's certainly impact. Mm. Yeah, definitely. That's amazing. What was your motivation behind the idea of standing for women's equality in that way?
Catherine Mayer and I, who co-founded the party together, sort of had the idea separately and then had it together. We just felt that unless you challenge politicians at the ballot box, you're never really going to get anywhere. Pressure groups are all very well, but nobody wants to lose votes. But it had to be a political party. Otherwise, it was just never going to succeed. Because you had to stand on the same terms as the Labour Party, the Tory Party, all of them, and say, this is what a political party could look like. And one of the things that we do each election is we take our manifesto, and with all our perfectly, brilliantly costed policies, like, you know, free child, universal childcare, and we take them to each of the party headquarters and we say, here are our policies and here is our manifesto. Please steal every single policy that would make us really happy. And so far, as I understand it, the only party who has refused to take receipt of the manifesto is the Labour Party. Make of that what you will.
What was it then that motivated your feminism in the first instance? I mean, you know, because lots of people on this podcast have been feminists. They've often had different reasons, you know, frustration at a grandmother who didn't get the education she should have, or, you know, their own experiences of inequality, or looking at the world and seeing the, you know, wasted talent or suffering, or seeing the possibilities of a more equal world. What was it that took you in that direction?
Well, it's probably not a story that reflects terribly well on me, I think, but my kind of consciousness raising, I was six, I think, maybe five, and I was attending a French-speaking convent in Copenhagen. This is the strange upbringing that I've had. And it was pouring with rain, and the nuns allowed the boys to go out and play, and all the girls had to stay in and do colouring. And I was incensed, absolutely incensed. So I took my colouring pencils and I made a poster that declared that we were going to go on strike. The girls were going to go on strike. We wanted to go out and play. Wasn't okay. This was not a way to treat people. I was absolutely enraged. I put my posters up and I spoke to the other girls. And nobody really wanted to join in. But anyway, I caused enough fuss that Mother Superior did, in a rather sort of Sound of Music way, did arrive and say that we could go out to play. So it was a complete and utter triumph. My first campaign, total and utter triumph, apart from the fact that all the other girls were furious because they just wanted to stay inside.
So, well, there's a terrible lesson in that somewhere. That's a terrible lesson.
In telling people what ought to be good for them.
You will be free.
Yes, come, my people. but I think it woke up in me the inequities in life. I saw my mother had worked for the BBC when she met my dad. They met at the BBC. She was an announcer. My dad came from Denmark to train at the BBC. Was still is, I think, amongst the best broadcasting in the world. And as soon as they got married, which is 1954, my mother had to leave her job because married women were not allowed at that time to work for the BBC. I don't know. I have no idea why. I can't even think of a reason why.
No.
And that loss of career for my mother seemed an outrage to me. And I would watch my dad go off to work and do all these exciting things and interview presidents and sit with Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra and do chats and, you know, all of this amazing stuff that he did as a foreign correspondent. And my mother was at home, miserable in the kitchen. It's not okay.
Did you draw any moral lessons or other things that informed your sort of your worldview now from your mother?
From my mum? Yeah, I mean, I think she's a talented, she's still alive, she's 92. She's a talented woman whose talents were never allowed to be properly expressed. She's dealt with that stoically. Weirdly, the lesson that I learned from that is maybe don't, maybe get more angry, maybe become more furious, but it wasn't the time. It wasn't, you know, it was the 60s and 70s. It literally wasn't the time. If you think about, we've just had the football. Women were banned from football till 1971. The idea that my mother could, you know, the FA would not allow women to play football at all until 1971. The idea that my mother could have stood up and fought more is not fair on her. She literally couldn't. But I think it probably gave me more fight to watch her not get up and do things. I think a lot of my, it's perhaps unfair because my dad was out in the world, but a lot of my moral views and ethical views come from my father, probably more, more than anywhere. And I once said to him, what will you do, Dad, if you die and you're hauled before God and asked why you did not believe? And he said, I shall look him in the eye and say, sir, you gave me insufficient evidence.
Very good. So he was quite a fan of humanist approach to life as well. Then was he? I didn't know that.
Absolutely. Okay. So in Denmark, when I was a child, it was a matter of law that everybody belonged to the state church. I don't know if this has changed, but it was as a child. And if you wanted to leave the state church, which basically meant you no longer wished any portion of your taxes to go to support the church, you actually had to have a private members' bill passed in Parliament. I mean, it's a small country. You had to have a private members' bill passed in Parliament to say that you wished to leave the church. Now, that's quite a palaver, isn't it? That's quite a lot of faff. He did that. He did that, and it was a nightmare when we wanted to get him buried.
Oh, yeah, of course it is. Well, reap what you sow, you know.
I know. Anyway, this is where fame triumphs over faith, because he is buried in the church of his choosing.
Wow.
Because we had to put him somewhere.
Yeah. And everyone accepted that.
He's very famous, so they overlooked the fact that he wasn't a member of the church.
A moment ago, you talked about, or you alluded to, your education at the hands of nuns.
I know, weird, right?
Right. And I suppose that can't have left you unaffected, one way or another. So there must be something in that, isn't there? How did that change you?
It changed me in that they would talk all the time about love, and we're actually, I think, amongst the meanest group of people I've ever met in my entire life. They were just not nice. They were not nice, and I knew that as a child. When I was, I first went to school at the age of four because I was, must have been annoying at home. I was desperate to get on. And my mother would take me to school on the back of her bicycle. And if you were late, you had to, the punishment was to sit on these very dark stairs that led up to the nuns' sleeping quarters upstairs in this very, very old building. And it was very dark and quite frightening, and I was only four. And I remember saying to Mother Bernadette, never forgotten, I don't know why I'm being punished. Surely my mother should sit in the dark, because I'm on the back of the bicycle. I can't decide when we get here. It's not up to me to decide when we get here. Which I thought was very good and logical.
Sounds human far rights, too logical for
human
a
human rights lawyer kind of it is, argument. It is. But no, nevertheless, I still sat on
but
the
that
stairs.
Wasn't fair, was it?
Well, that's the thing is, that's what even at four or five, you start thinking, wait a minute, this is not nice. Why not have a word? We couldn't take the car to America. It was very old. It wasn't really worth anything. And so they decided, or that maybe the nuns persuaded them that they had this car. Anyway, the chief top nun came from Belgium. One day she was coming for a visit, and the whole school, I only know this from a letter we received from Mother Bernadette, the whole school had gathered outside. And in those days, we wore sailors' uniforms. That was the uniform for the school, right? Honestly, it was like unbelievably Sound of Music. So the whole school is lined up in sailors' uniforms. And Mother Bernadette is driving, and top nun from Brussels is in the front, and two nuns in the back. And these were the days before they had changed anything. They had the full wimple, you know, the white thing and the black outfit and so on. And as they arrived, with all these children waving a combination of Danish and French flags, the bottom of the car fell out, and all of the nuns completely disappeared from view. My father laughed for days and days at the thought of this. But they'd only written to tell him that he needed to get somebody to come and take the car away. Anyway, it's a terrible story.
Oh, that's not fair, is it? For him to have to take the car away, you broke it, you fix it. They should sort it out themselves.
I'm just going to introduce you to the world of that particular lot of nuns.
But it didn't have any effect on you religiously.
It did. It did. We used to be taken into the chapel. It was large, very high ceilings. I mean, I was a small child in the sailor's uniform. What did I know? But it seemed enormous to me. And we would watch the novices, the young nuns swearing their, I don't know what they're doing. They're swearing their allegiance to God. And they would have to lie on the floor, face down, with their arms out and across, I don't know, kiss the hem of the Mother Superior's dress or something. And I was very taken by this. This is a very dramatic moment. And there would be singing, and it seemed rather an extraordinary moment. So I took to going in my break times to lying on the floor in the chapel on the marble floor with my arms out like this, because I thought, God will surely, there'll be something, there'll be lightning or... I was very taken with the idea of a Lamb of God. I thought this would be a rather marvellous thing. And I was pretty sure, because I was very young, that I was without sin. I was unaware of having done anything. So I thought, anyway, I did this for several weeks. And I never heard a word. So I remember getting up. It was actually a very pivotal moment, because it was genuine. My belief that something amazing was going to happen was genuine. And I got up and I looked up at the big, this massive cross, really, you know, one of those ones with really unpleasant lot of blood and really a very gory depiction of execution. It was very unpleasant. And I just looked up and I just thought, well, it seems very silly. And I left. And I remember talking to my father about crucifixion. He said, it's very odd, isn't it? He said, we might as well have people wearing necklaces with the electric chair on them or something. It's a sort of an odd, it's a very odd thing to be devoted to choose as the symbol of hope, extremely unpleasant method of killing somebody.
Yes. And I think many, many people who are raised within some sort of religious context or within a religious school, perhaps that's one of the things that puts them off, is that strange, that very graphic imagery that seems to mean very little now, at least. Yeah.
Although there's a very interesting thing. There's one of the most, I love anything to do with history and archaeology, and there's an incredible Viking museum in Jelling in Jutland in Denmark. And amongst the things is a cast, a thing that a silversmith would use to cast jewellery. The Vikings were incredible jewellers, which my father brought up at Kiritikana was singing. Anyway, Vikings were incredible jewellers. And it has two sections in it on the same cast. And one is Thor's hammer and the other is the Christian cross. And you can see the similarity between the two. And here is a guy making money, hedging his bets, going, which one do you want? Which one do you think is going to protect you? But it's very interesting to see the shape of the one right next to the other. And you can see how humanity harks back to something, you know, even older. It's really interesting.
Mm. You said at the Congress that you thought that love originally sat at the heart of at least most religions and philosophies at the point when they were, you know, first promulgated, you know, the original purpose of them and so on. Is that something that you really do believe or that you look for? I tell you why that thought was stimulated was just then when you were drawing attention to the common roots or common, you know, origins of all different human philosophies and religions. Do you think that love really is such an enormous motivating factor as that? And is it in your life?
It certainly is in my life. There's no question about it. Love and passion are my, I think, probably my driving forces. But I do think if you study religion, and I think you know I've read the religious texts extremely thoroughly.
Yes.
I do think at their core there is love. I think all of the depictions of Jesus, so this is not a man who goes about saying you're a bad person, or this is...
No. Yes, he's not a nun, is he?
He's not like a nun. I mean, he gets crossed with a fig tree, but that's, you know, haven't we all?
Yes.
So I do think at the core of Islam, at the core of Judaism, at the core of Christianity, love ought to be the driving force. Too often, unfortunately, it is forgotten. As people endlessly interpret and reinterpret words, one of the problems with text of any kind, if you look at the problems with the American Constitution and people analyzing the Second Amendment, they've analyzed it into something that was never meant. And I think that you can find the same in any text that human beings have ever created. We will find the thing we're looking for. So you could, in the old days, you could, for example, say slavery is fine because of the story of the curse of Ham, which is one of my favorite stories. But you forget about the... what ought to be at the core is that we're all equal, that there is love. And if people could maybe just seek the initial imperatives of writing those things down, the initial thing was that they were loved by God. Isn't that the main driving thing? And that from that ought to radiate all kinds of love. But instead it's used to vilify people and to make some groups of people feel superior to others, as I think the LGBT community will attest to at the moment.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think that's a good last thing to come on to, blending as it does love and equality and imagining yourself in other people's shoes and everything else. Obviously, recently, and this was another big part of what you spoke about at the Congress, the human rights and equality of LGBT people very much in the headlines, and I think in the forefront of lots of the minds of those of us who work for progress generally and against religious and other types of oppression. That's been something that you've spent more time on recently. Not that you're ever out of the fight, but you know, you marched, for example, this year in the Pride parade in London with Stonewall at the head of their what do you call it, delegation, contingent,
I guess. Yeah.
Legion.
Gang.
Yes, the head of their gang. This is something that is rising in salience, at least for you at the present time.
I mean, I was very upset. The Archbishop of Canterbury returned from a synod with all of the bishops, and the main takeaway seemed to be to reaffirm the position of LGBT people as not fully equal members of the Church of England family. And so here's the thing, he's entitled to believe that, he's entitled to say it, he's entitled to put forward that view. Where I feel enraged is that he's also entitled, along with 25 other Church of England bishops, to sit in the House of Lords and pass laws. And when same-sex marriage was voted upon, 9 bishops turned up and they all voted against. This is not okay. So, of course, I will defend to the death your right to say things that I don't agree with, but I will not agree that in a democracy you then get to, as it were, vote my life out of the picture. So that is what spurred me on recently. I find it very odd. You know, it's one of those things that just slightly baffles me, that a religious person says we're all created by God, but some of you were created not so well. Like, does he have off days? I don't know how that. I don't know how it works. Some of us are not okay. I remember some years ago, I was due to 1994. I was due to host a big event for the Save the Children Fund, I'd done lots of stuff for them before. I'd been an ambassador for them before, and I came out in 1994, and they dropped me as an ambassador, and there was a sort of sense of, let's save the children, but not all of them. Let's not save everybody. And it's that notion in particularly evangelical religion that it's a pick and mix. We can have some people who will be okay and some people who will not. And I don't know.
Are you worried about the general atmosphere?
Yes.
In the world now?
Very. Yeah. Very. Mm. I think if you look at some of the candidates for president, DeSantis is running on an openly anti-gay platform. It's become a sort of touchstone of how Republican you are, how conservative you are. And one of the ways to do it is to pick a minority group and have a go at them. It's happened over and over in the past. It happens to migrants. It happens to all kinds of ethnic minorities. And the LGBT group is in the firing line for sure at the moment. Homophobic hate crime is on the rise in the UK. And all I can do is keep standing up and keep saying I'm here. And I won't pick and choose who gets to be loved. That's not all right.
Love of truth, diversity of experience, active thoughtfulness, impatience, and 3 sources for everything you want to believe in. Sandy Toksvig, thank you for telling us what you believe.
Okay.
What I Believe is a weekly podcast from Humanist UK. We'll be releasing new episodes every Thursday. If you'd like to support the podcast, find out more about humanism, Humanist UK, and the work that we do, you can find out more on the Humanist UK website, humanists.uk. And if you like what you see, please consider signing up as a member or a supporter. You can also find out more about humanism by purchasing the Sunday Times bestseller, The Little Book of Humanism, available at all good bookshops.